You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Monday morning, April the 9th. So are we consumed by consumerism, buying stuff? And if so, so what? We'll talk with a guest who says it is a big deal that many of us are obsessed with consumerism, and we will wonder if you agree or not or have any questions for him. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890. Our guest is Benjamin Barber, who you may remember as the author of Jihad versus McWorld. That was a big bestseller in the mid-90s, about 10 years ago or so. He has a new book out, which is also of interest to you, I'm sure, Consumed, How Markets Corrupt Children, Infantilize Adults, and Swallow Citizens Whole. In it, he talks about how our character and our society are changing because of the consumerism in our lives. And he talks about how we should all stand up to current market trends because a lot is at stake. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Let me welcome our guest, Benjamin Barber, a distinguished senior fellow at DEMOS, a national nonpartisan public policy organization based in New York, a distinguished university professor at the University of Maryland, founder and director of CivWorld Project and its annual Interdependence Day event. Mr. Barber writes for Harper's, The New York Times, The Atlantic, and other major publications, and again, author of several books, including his latest, Consumed, How Markets Corrupt Children, Infantilize Adults, and Swallow Citizens Whole. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, well, why don't we just start with how markets corrupt children?
Well, yes, there's a little backdrop that's really useful because I think every one of your listeners knows that we live in an era of mass consumerism. People have been talking about conspicuous consumption for a very long time, and we know that society has advertising and marketing everywhere and so on, and the targeting younger and younger children all the way down to the baby Einstein and baby first television channels and so forth is around. And what I'm trying to do in Consumed is not just describe that phenomena, those phenomena, but also to actually explain them and suggest that it's not just incidental to our times, but is a feature of the logic of postmodern capitalism, that this goes to the heart of capitalism kind of running off the tracks.
Yeah, why is it running off the tracks to advertise stuff for kids?
Well, the first explanation is that it has been actually too successful. The great classical formula of capitalism that goes back 500 years is this remarkable hitching up of self-interest and altruism around the formula that if you will develop goods and services to meet the real needs and wants of people, you can improve society, create a more prosperous society, answer real needs, and make a profit on the way. And that formula had, you know, is what made America great. It was hooked up in the 18th and 19th century with Protestantism and Puritanism. Work hard, save, invest, defer gratification, a whole set of values that were good for capitalism, but also good for America and good for the core society. Now, the problem, I argue, today is that capitalism has succeeded so well in the United States and in the developed West, at least among the middle and upper classes, that it has largely met most of the real core needs and wants that we have for transportation, for kitchens, for housing, for clothes, for just about everything that we need for communication and so forth. And the result is, in recent decades, instead of manufacturing goods to answer real needs and wants, it has been busy manufacturing needs to sell all the goods it continues to have to sell to stay in business.
Yeah. For example...
And, you know, a great example is bottled water.
Mm-hmm.
We live in a country from which your tap, you can get enough clean water to do yourself very good. There's no American who cannot get clean water from the tap, unlike some other countries around the world. Yet we sell today, we buy as customers $10 billion a year in bottled, so-called boutique water that we don't really need.
Yeah.
Well, elsewhere in the world, there are billions of people who don't have potable water, who don't have clean water, are literally dying for water, and there, those very real needs are not being met by capitalism. So capitalism is, in effect, making its profits from meeting contrived and faux needs here in the developed world and not doing what it once did so well, finding entrepreneurial ways to address real needs elsewhere.
Well, are we all just a bunch of lemmings or dull that maybe we want to buy bottled water because we like the convenience of bottled water? We enjoy the taste of bottled water. It doesn't mean that we're having the wool pulled over our eyes, does it?
Well, it's not about wool pulled over our eyes. It's about really a logic of capitalism and a logic of need and want. And the problem is, you know, if this was a good that had some real meaning, you wouldn't require the billions and billions of dollars that go into more, not just advertising, but into marketing. You wouldn't require these campaigns that say, well, you may not think you need Botox to freeze your face with a poison into youthful aspects so you can pretend you're 30 years younger than you actually are. But in fact, the pharmaceutical companies are busy selling us Botox as a poison to freeze our face. Well, again, in the third world, those pharmaceuticals could be developing inexpensive retroviral drugs to meet the world HIV plague that's all over the place. Another example. A third example would be, you know, we buy, 600 thread count sheets, 1,200 thread count sheets?
Yeah, I never did get that.
and yet in the third world, one thread count mosquito nets would make a tremendous difference in staving off malaria, protecting the immune systems of kids who then later become compromised by HIV because they've gotten malaria and other mosquito-borne diseases. And again, I'm not suggesting just giving those away. I'm suggesting that you could actually make a business out of that. You could help the developing world develop its own entrepreneurial base. You could, in effect, bring it into the capitalist age. So again, this isn't an attack on markets and capitalism, but an attack on the way in which they've distorted our economy and at the same time not addressed the real economies, even, say, in New Orleans, where there's a real need for capitalist entrepreneurship, but you don't find much today.
Yeah. When you brought up the Botox, that reminded me of the infantilizing adults. The marketers are what, cashing in on our insecurities that we want to be forever young?
They are, but the reason they're doing it, again, I want to bring it back to the logic of capitalism, the reason they're doing it is they got all this stuff to sell. And the easiest way to sell stuff to people is to kind of turn us into shopaholics, to impulsive buyers, to in effect turn us back into kids. You know, growing up, being an adult is partly about prudence, self-restraint, a diversified life, a pluralistic life. I mean, as human beings, we are creatures who pray and play and make love and create art and do recreation and worship in religion and so forth. And we also have to buy. Consumption is one vital, important part of our life, but it can't be all of our lives. But when you're not shopping, you're not propping up a stumbling capitalism. So for the marketers today, it's not enough that we shop sometimes. We need to shop all of the time. It's not enough that we see ads sometime. We have to see ads everywhere, on the internet, in television, on the signage, all over our public places, when we're awake and when we sleep, on the telephone, just about everywhere. So it's the pervasiveness, the ubiquity of commerce and signage and marketing that disturbs me, not the simple fact that we all are, among other things, shoppers.
Yeah. So as I asked in my introduction, so what if a lot of us are big shoppers?
Well, the problem is that it drives out everything else in the society, and we, in effect, commodify, commercialize, and create a society that is dominated only by one domain of our lives. And, you know, nobody asks, so what if religion dominates every single sector of our society? When you live in a society that is dominated everywhere by religion, it's called a theocracy, mm-hmm. And we rightly don't like it. When you live in a society that's dominated everywhere by politics and ideology, it's called totalitarianism. And we just defeated, you know, after 100 years, totalitarianism, not just in Nazi Germany, but in Soviet Russia. We all know that's a problem. But we are living in a society increasingly dominated everywhere in every domain by commerce, by advertising, by consumption, by acquisition, and by materialism. That, to me, is another form of totalizing a society, driving out diversity, driving out pluralism, and has the same totalizing effects of narrowing down and homogenizing human life that ought to be bad for us and that we ought to be resisting.
Yeah, isn't it called capitalism?
No, it's not. Capitalism is developing goods and services to meet real needs. And you got to show me that there's real need for an iPhone. There's real need for changing your face by the knife to look like Britney Spears or Paris Hilton, which is now a big business. Cosmetic surgery. You've got to show me that there's a real need among bald people for Head and Shoulders. Yet, you know, I've seen a famous advertising executive say, I still use Head and Shoulders. I love that product. I've been bald for 15 years. But, you know, I mean, you have to explain to me how that's either a need or a want in any sense that relates to capitalism. I mean, capitalism is not simply a form of exploiting us. It has been a form of producing the wealth and goods we need to lead lives that are much more than just capitalistic.
We are talking with Benjamin Barber. He is a political scientist, and he's also the author of Consumed: How Markets Corrupt Children, Infantilize Adults, and Swallow Citizens Whole. We are talking about the economy of consumerism, how it influences the political personality and the cultural character of American citizens. And we will talk with Benjamin Barber also on what he thinks we ought to do about all this. Can you stand up to current market trends? Can you say no? 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you along on this Monday, April the 9th. Hoping you'll stay tuned. It's At Issue with Gene Purcell in for Ben Marins this afternoon between 4 and 6. Gene and his guest after 5 o'clock this afternoon will explore the history of the alternative minimum tax. That's coming up after 5 o'clock. We're talking about consumerism, too much of it. Talking with our guest who wrote the book Consumed, Benjamin Barber, and you can talk with him too, 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Before we go to the phones and our lines filled up quickly, Benjamin Barber, how do you suggest we resist this consumerism?
Well, the first thing is to understand it's not just a matter of that we've been corrupted and we're, you know, too dumb to resist and don't know what's going on. I mean, the difference between this society and previous societies is that in most previous societies, the primary educational and religious and political institutions helped us grow up and helped us resist easy materialism, helped reinforce a adult, prudent, diversified, pluralistic life, whereas most of the institutions around today do the opposite. They try to keep us children. They try to keep us as shoppers because capitalism is now, the marketplace is dominating everything else, and in a sense, some people say it's all about money and greed. I don't think it's about that, but it is about a capitalism that is afraid if we stop shopping for even 5 minutes, it's going to go under, so that religious holidays now are shopping days, so that stores are open all night, so that during that Thanksgiving period, right after Thanksgiving, that's the most profitable time of the year for retail stores now stay open all night. People are in lines for the sales and so forth. It's a distortion of degree, and that may not seem very much, but that distortion of degree ultimately is what all poison is about, whether it's theocracy, where a distortion of degree makes religion the only thing, or a commercial society in which shopping becomes the only thing. And the other thing is, of course, that we are doing it all the way down. Even people who say, well, well, look, the adults, they get what they deserve. They have to defend themselves. But when they target our children, when marketers talk about parents as gatekeepers who have to be removed from in front of their children so that the marketers and the advertisers can get at the kids and get them to spend the discretionary income of their parents, in effect, remove the gatekeepers but leave their wallets behind so the kids can be big spenders, we've got to feel there's something wrong with that, just in terms of protecting children from pernicious influences.
To the phones we go. Tammy in Appleton is with us first. Hi, Tammy. You're on the air.
Hi. I've been hearing commercials on TV that are probably from some lobby group trying to get cable TV for lower rates, and you're supposed to call your representative and all this kind of stuff. And it's just amazing to me that we have people who want our representatives to spend time getting us something more of what we don't need for a cheaper price instead of spending their time, you know, feeding poor people, preventing suicide, and doing things that are really important for life.
Yeah, there's it's a state legislation that would open up competition in the cable TV market. Benjamin Barber, in case you're not aware specifically of what Tammy was talking about, you want to react, though, to that concept?
Well, I think she makes a really makes a good point, because what we see increasingly also is that our politicians are putting themselves at the service of consumerism rather than trying to help us. To help us oppose it. And, of course, the whole last 30 or 40 years of privatization, of getting government out and putting the market first and foremost, that started with Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher and the so-called Chicago School of Economics, all of that has actually helped disarm the public and take away their common decision-making powers to regulate and oversee capitalism. And one of the facts about capitalism is that it is always done best in partnership with democracy. If you look at the times when it's left to its own devices and the raw market goes its own way, as after the Civil War, when we created the Gilded Age of cartels and monopoly, even though we were supposed to be creating an age of competition. When you look at the 1920s, before the New Deal really set in, those were times when capitalism didn't just hurt democracy, but actually was undermined by its own contradictions. And the healthiest periods for capitalism has always been when it is working together in tandem with democracy. And we are working in another period now for the last 30 years where, as your caller said, government seems to be at the service of capitalism rather than at the service of the citizenry, finding ways to direct, regulate, oversee, and keep capitalism inside the kind of moderate boundaries that allow it to do well.
Thank you, Tammy. Jan in Ashland is with us now. Hi, Jan.
Hi, good morning, and thank you both so much for this important information. And I may not even need to say this because I think your guest just said it, but a couple of weeks ago on Wisconsin Public Radio, I heard something that made me realize that the word capitalism is not synonymous with democracy. And I'll take the response off the air. Thank you.
Benjamin Barber?
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. Capitalism has its strengths and weaknesses, and so does democracy. They're not the same thing. Sometimes I think in America nowadays, we think if you have a full-fledged 24-hour-a-day market economy, you've got democracy. And, of course, what happened in places like Russia after the fall of the Soviet Union was that they thought as soon as they got capitalism in the market, they'd have democracy. Today in Russia, you have an awful lot of crazy capitalism, not much in the way of democracy. You need both. They're two different things. And they work very well together. When we use capitalism to push our entrepreneurship, individualism, and getting prosperity produced, but we use democracy to create social justice, to regulate capitalism, to keep it from collapsing around its own contradictions, to regulate the advertisers, and to protect our children, to help parents gatekeep against the assault on them that otherwise comes from marketers. That's a partnership that we have more or less dropped. And in doing so, as I say, that what we've actually done is disempower ourselves with the common powers that we once had and do have potentially through democracy to make capitalism work for us instead of us working for capitalism.
Yeah, and aren't you are making the point that this consumption or overconsumption is actually a threat to our democracy.
It's a deep threat to our democracy, too, of course, because it what it does, and this is a subtle but important point, it makes us think that the freedom we have as private choosers, as private consumers, the freedom we have in choosing 1,000 different brands of toothpaste and 200 different brands of automobile is all the choice we need, and it tries to persuade us that the public liberty, the public choice that we get as citizens isn't necessary. But to just take one example of, you know, why that isn't so, if you go to a city like Los Angeles today, you have endless choices of the kind of private transportation you can have, and the brand of automobiles you can get from Hertz or includes all kinds of domestic and foreign cars, and a prestige series, and a fun series, and a family series, and so forth. Any choice you want of private transportation. The one choice you don't have is of a decent public transportation system, and no amount of consumer private choice can do that. As with the environment, as with so many important things, it's only through public choice, through democracy, through our role as citizens, not as consumers, that we can control and determine the shape of our public environment. The result is that in only making private decisions, we find that our private decisions often have inadvertent social and public consequences that we don't really like, so that we all choose as individuals to drive cars, but we don't like the fact that as a result we live in a country dependent on foreign oil, with 50, 60,000 casualties a year on the highways, with cars that are too large, take up too much space, use too much gas, and so forth. That has public consequences, but you can't control them just through private choice. That's what we do as citizens, and when we surrender our role as citizens, we actually disempower ourselves.
Our guest is Benjamin Barber. He is a political scientist, an author. His newest book is Consumed: How Markets Corrupt Children, Infantilize Adults, and Swallow Citizens Whole. We welcome your questions and comments for him at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890. We have an open line for you and time for you as well. Our next caller is Eric in Sheboygan. Hi, Eric. You're on the air.
Hello. Yeah, hi. I just woke up and I tuned in. I was curious to ask Benjamin. And I totally agree with Benjamin in the fact that the consumer capitalism is degrading our world and our society and our people. Now, we have things in the world that people like to purchase of their own will, and we have, you know, the sellers selling candy for cheaper than fruit or soda for cheaper than water. You know, it seems easier, you know, for a mom to go to McDonald's and pick up something someone cooked for her children for $5. Than to spend more at the grocery store to cook them a healthy meal and spend a lot of time doing it. How does Benjamin suggest that people make the transition from the world we have today and that consumerism and the unhealthy or unnecessary things that we get for ourselves into the more, I'm assuming, socialistic aspect, which I think we need as a society, because of the amount of people in the world, there needs to be a lot of things done in a more socialistic fashion in order to procure a healthy and safe society and world.
Benjamin Barber?
Well, you sure wake up thinking clearly. I would like to wake up with that clarity of mind. By the way, just because you know the country we live in as well as I do, you don't really need to use the word socialistic, which is a boo word and which will scare a lot of people into thinking that you're going to resurrect Stalinist Russia here in the United States. I mean, the key word to use is simply democratic, because democratic means we use our common power, our common decision-making to control the private institutions, to control advertising, to control access to children, to control marketing and so forth in exactly the way that you've suggested. But here's the thing. There are obviously some things that we can do as individuals. Obviously, parents can reassert their right to gatekeep for their children and protect their children. They do, you know, we can spend less time in front of our TVs, less time in front of the places where all that advertising goes on, and the internet and so on. The problem there is, though, because these commercial and consumer and marketing institutions are so ubiquitous, it's very hard to protect them. Because you say, look, I'm going to go out for a healthy walk in the park, and then you see that parks and many public institutions are now taking private advertising for the same goods. So you can't just do this one by one as consumers. We have to work together, and part of the project is political. which is to resurrect our sense of ourselves as citizens who take public responsibility for the public consequences of our private choices. And to do that, and I think it's already beginning to happen in the United States, we're seeing a kind of political revival and a willingness to think about the ways in which our democratic government can help us patrol the borders of our children, can help us protect against overzealous advertisers and marketers and so on. Also, young people themselves can do it. You know, young people sell their foreheads in college to advertisers. They literally, like slaves, sell their bodies as advertising signage, and they walk around college that way. We see our basketball players with brand logos cut into their haircuts. We see, and you walk around New York, you see young Jewish kids in yarmulkes that have brand logos like Nike stitched in over the Star of David. You know, so that in a sense, you're saying brand identity trumps our human identity, our religious identity, our identity as human beings. So you got to resist individually. It's true, but I think the real message here is that we have to take our democratic institutions seriously. We have to work together to protect ourselves against the common threats to our children, to ourselves, and to the diversity of our lives.
So if we all resist this consumerism, we only buy what we need and not this other stuff, what happens to all, you know, the iPod makers and
Well, here's the deal. The iPod makers, I mean, for example, you know, what's coming is the iPhone. And I know from experience, the Apple guys out there are all going to call in and say, well, we agree with everything you say, but don't do Apple any harm. Don't say anything against Apple. It's a great company. And in many ways, it is a good company. But these new iPhones that are coming out in a month or two that are going to not just take your calls and take pictures, but take you to the internet, show films and movies, and for all I know, walk your dog as well for you. These are, you know, this is one way to do things, but let me just make an alternative suggestion. Negroponte and some other Americans have shown that you can build a $75 or $100, maybe even a $50 laptop computer. There are billions of people who are computer illiterate and language illiterate, for whom a very inexpensive computer would be a great way to literacy, a great way into common work together, a great way to jump-starting their economies. And helped by microcredit, that wonderful idea from Mr. Yunus, he just won the Nobel Prize from Bangladesh, who suggested making small entrepreneurial loans to people in the third world so that they could start making stuff themselves and affording stuff that's there. Why doesn't Apple think about how to help develop a very inexpensive computer that can be sold to kids without funds here in the United States and sold abroad as well? Not given away. I'm not talking about philanthropy. We're talking about jump-starting capitalism, letting capitalism once again make its money by producing goods we really need. In the short run, that would take down profits a little bit because you've got to wait a little bit. But that's the whole point of capitalism, waiting for profits, reinvesting, doing enough to help create a customer base. Henry Ford said it a long time ago. He said, if we don't pay our workers enough so that they can buy our cars, who are we going to sell what we're making to? And the problem today is that, in effect, the marketers and the capitalists are not thinking about the future of a market. There are billions of new customers out there who have real needs. So how about capitalism addressing those needs, deferring its profits a little bit, and being in a position to create a much larger but balanced consumer economy around the world?
We're going out to Mary Pat in Wauwatosa. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I had a hard time describing to the screener what my point is, so bear with me here. you know, I've often heard conservatives point to this whole idea that they've created of the family is falling apart. You know, people are single parenting and gay people are adopting, and, you know, so the family is now what it used to be, and that's this big social ill that's creating the mess we're in culturally. But I'm wondering if what your guest is suggesting, that capitalism gone awry, is really what's causing so much of this, crime and drugs or whatever the conservatives think is wrong with our society, that hedonism is creating this, the digital divide and the haves and the have-nots, and that's what's really creating the society that we have right now, greed and hedonism.
Well, I think they ought to hire you as a screener if the screeners understand that, because that's a great point, and it does go to the very heart, I think, of what I want to argue in Consumed, and that is that we live in a society in which in which what we buy and how we consume is being determined for us by others and robbing us of our capacity to make wise choices. In the 60s and 70s, the conservatives said over and over again, the state, the government, is undermining the right of parents to bring up their own children, that socialism and democracy undermine family values. But where are they now when it's all market and no government? Government's been pushed aside, and as you say, it is the market that is undermining our family values. It is the market that is pushing this trash, this pornography, this Hollywood crap and so on down the throats of our parents. It is the market that is saying, let's get the gatekeepers out of the way. Conservatives have rightly said parents have to be responsible gatekeepers. They have to protect their family values. But when the primary institutions of the market are making war on the gatekeepers, making war on parents and targeting children, I would think that at that point, we would have the help of conservatives who would say, well, if the old enemy was big government, today the enemy of children and families are big markets. Unfortunately, we don't hear that. Maybe we will. I have on some conservative talk shows had some response to my arguments that says, you're right, the new problem is the targeting of children, the targeting of parents and family values by markets and by materialist values.
Our guest, Benjamin Barber. He is the author of Consumed: How Markets Corrupt Children, Infantilize Adults, and Swallow Citizens Whole. Benjamin Barber is a distinguished senior fellow at DEMOS, a national nonpartisan public policy organization, and also a distinguished university professor at the University of Maryland, author of a bestseller previously, Jihad versus McWorld. Remember that one? 1-800-642-1234 if you'd like to talk to him. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Good to have you along. Hope you stay tuned. Peter Donald's in for Kathleen Dunn coming up after 9 o'clock. Peter and his guest will discuss the major headlines in the news, from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's trip to Syria and the latest on the showdown over between Congress and the Bush administration over war spending. That's coming up. Peter Donald's in for Kathleen Dunn after 9 o'clock this morning. Our next caller for Benjamin Barber is David in De Pere. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Good morning. Good morning, Professor Barber. Good to hear you in Wisconsin again.
Thanks. Good morning.
I have a comment and a question that goes along with it. And this, generally, the comment is, it seems that there is a necessity for heavy consumer spending in this economy in order to prop it up. For example, the last recession, where people just kept spending, despite the fact we were in a pretty significant recession. And I was just hearing recently some discussion in the news about how the business cycle may no longer be a reality because, and I think it has to do with this idea that regardless of when, you know, things are not looking good economically, consumers just seem to keep spending. And related to that are also, matters have been in the news recently about predatory practices in the mortgage and credit industry. These practices, of course, aim precisely at people who are in financial need. People, as they were saying, people who really years ago wouldn't be able to qualify for mortgages are getting them, but under these questionable conditions and credit cards and so forth. And I'm wondering if, you know, if we think of the traditional Marxian critique of capitalism, that it is tendency to overproduction is what leads it to crisis. And I wonder if that tendency toward overproduction is being artificially modified by these practices where, you know, traditionally the overproduction would be a result of people not being able to afford to buy these commodities that flood the market. But what we do is we try to enable people who really can't afford to buy them to buy them, but of course it puts them in a greater financial dire straits. And I was just wondering what you thought about that.
Well, I think you make exactly the right connection between overproduction of goods that we don't really need and that maybe even threaten us in some ways, but that capitalism needs us to need to stay afloat, and the credit crisis and the mortgage crisis. Because, I mean, this is the first time in history when a major industrial nation has a negative savings rate. You know, we're actually negative, which means we have more credit than we have savings. And nowadays, your savings bank is another source of credit cards. It's amazing. If you go bankrupt in this country, within a month of your declaration of bankruptcy, you will get a half dozen offers from credit card companies to get another credit card and to deal with your debt that way. So there's no question that the banking industry is, in a sense, supporting the overproduction by saying, hey, we need you to buy even if you haven't got anything. And, of course, we got into the mortgage crisis, the housing crisis, because an awful lot of people who really weren't ready yet to afford their first home were talked into buying homes at subprime and at rates that after a couple of years jump up double, and of course they now end up in bankruptcy, and the banks are actually in trouble. But the logic of capitalism, as you say, and overproduction suggests that you've got to do this. You've got to do this because otherwise capitalism goes under. So the real question is, I think implicit in yours and perhaps in the previous callers as well, is how do we get capitalism back to doing what it once did well, responding to real needs without producing this artificial society in which, unless we shop all the time for things we don't really need and in many cases for things that are bad for us, think about the salt, grease, and sugar diet foods that are produced by the fast food industry for our children that have created a nation of obesity. I mean, you want to see the difference between real capitalism and phony capitalism. We are creating a nation of obese kids when there are kids elsewhere in the world starving. How about capitalism figuring out how to develop goods like, in the third world, what's called plumpy nut paste, a 500-calorie peanut bar that's wrapped and sealed against the elements that actually can bring kids back to normal nutrition within a few weeks. So we really need to think about how to re-gear capitalism, because my whole point is that this isn't just the result of greedy marketers or stupid consumers. It is the result of a logic of capitalism that suggests unless it keeps producing more and more of what we don't need and forcing us to buy it by phony and dangerous credit and so forth, capitalism goes under. And we don't want capitalism to go under. We don't want the economy to go under. So the project becomes how you get capitalism going back to doing the right thing. Let me give you one example, though, of how it works badly here and well in some other places. 15 years ago, GM, General Motors, when it was still the leading manufacturer of cars in the world, was one of the first to jump into the hybrid market and to realize that gas-guzzling SUVs in the long term weren't the way to go. And they developed a very good pioneering hybrid engine. But almost immediately, the pressure for short-term profits and so on led them to abandon their hybrid project and turn to trucks and SUVs, which back then were the big sellers in America. Toyota, which hadn't been in that business, picked up and even borrowed some of GM's hybrid things, saying, we'll put off profits. We're going to look to the long run at real needs, and the world, what the world needs is a hybrid car, a non-gas guzzler, a non-emission car. They got big time into the business. The result is today, as GM is in bigger and bigger trouble, laying off more and more people, selling fewer and fewer cars, Toyota and other Japanese companies have made hybrids one of the key bases for their business. They deferred gratification. They put off profit-taking. They looked at a good idea based on a real need, the need for cars that don't gas guzzle. And the result is they are a much more successful capitalist corporation today than General Motors.
Well, speaking of this, Bill in Deerfield has been waiting. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Joy. Hi, Mr. Barber. Nice to talk to College Park. I had some good times there at Cumberland Hall back in the 70s.
Good.
I want to get to your point you were making about small entrepreneurs a few minutes ago. And I think what we have is a corrupted capitalism that both subverts democracy and the free market. And my example is the biggest company that we have in this country, maybe in the world, is ExxonMobil. And they have not paid any of the royalties that were due the Treasury, hundreds of millions of dollars of royalties. And they're also, they've got the benefit of the U.S. military keeping their supply lines open. And this is definitely at the expense of small entrepreneurs. And beyond that, they also get to sit in on energy meetings with the vice president to make energy policy. So, you know, we don't have a real capitalist society. We have a crony capitalist society, and it also subverts democracy, and it also subverts small entrepreneurs.
Well, I don't have much to add to that, because you put it very eloquently. I mean, the fact is that our political institutions and our government and our democracy seem to be doing nothing but serving capitalism rather than regulating it, overseeing it, and representing civic interests to make it work well. And again, the point of sovereignty, political sovereignty and democratic sovereignty, is that our will as citizens and common choosers ought to, in fact, dominate our private choices, whereas in our country it's exactly the opposite. We see our public institutions, in effect, sitting at the feet of runaway market commercial capitalism and doing things that not only do subvert democracy, as you say, but that also, in the long run, undo capitalism as well.
Thanks a lot, Bill, for the call. Earl in Brown Deer. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning, Joy, and good morning to your guests. I have a question that I struggle with every time we have a presidential election coming up. And it gets back to all the things you've been discussing about capitalism, consumerism, and so forth. But the difficult thing is, how do you get people to look at some of the liberal or progressive things that has made this country so great in the past without them being attacked as wacko on the left ideas? And as an example of that, right now in Milwaukee, we've had a big project going on called the Marquette Interchange, where we are spending millions of dollars to reconstruct infrastructure that was actually falling apart. You could see the concrete coming off of the steel on the bridges and so forth, and those are being rebuilt. But I go through other cities and see the same thing. Why can't people understand that if the government spends money on our infrastructure, it puts our citizens to work, it creates a healthy environment for our country, and it is not socialistic, but it's capitalistic. I'd like to take your comments off the air. Thank you.
Well, another strong point, and the caller is exactly right. Attempts to defend democracy often get equated with the defense of socialism. The attempt to defend regulating capitalism to help it work well is called communistic. And, of course, we have a propaganda machine among some people on the right and in the libertarian market sector who do think that every intervention by democratic institutions, every intervention by citizens to contain the impulses of consumers is a sign of some form of totalitarian state rule. And we simply have to resist that. I mean, from the very beginning, the people whose private interests are interrupted by democracy have tried to make war on democracy and vilify and belittle small-d Democrats. I'm not talking about Democrats and Republicans, but people who believe in democracy working together using common power to regulate private power. And in a world nowadays where so much private power is being used to push back and colonize and direct public power, we're going to constantly be up against a propaganda machine that says anyone who believes in citizenship or democracy is some kind of a throwback socialist. But the most important point I think we have to make is that we're not just defending democracy, we are defending the market. We are defending competition and entrepreneurship and a capitalism that produces needed goods to meet real wants instead of dumbing down adults, infantilizing adults, targeting children to buy stuff that they don't need and nobody needs, but the only ones who need it are the capitalist producers who produce it because they can't be bothered to take the risk, and risk is what capitalism is about, to meet real needs and real wants.
Thanks to Earl. Now, Mark in Richland Center. Go ahead, you're on the air.
I appreciate everything that you're saying, and I think that we need to offer suggestions as to how to get beyond this that can come down to the local level. We had a local meeting in our town in Viroqua about what to do for these problems. And we need to at least address the issues of what the community can do together to pool their resources, either in buying the commodities that the community uses, or maybe even sharing in material goods that they already have, lawnmowers, rototillers, cars. The whole business of sharing resources has been told to us is a crazy thing. So that addresses the educational system, is that we really need to push this business of sharing as a community responsibility instead of the individualism that is foisted on us by a media that's so rampantly, heavily motivated by advertising. And then I might ask a question is whether or not you think that the whole idea of private property is in our way, because the privatization of land holding itself has really gotten in the way of our communal capabilities.
Let me try to answer quickly both those questions. The sharing is a great notion, as you know, in places like Portland, Oregon, and elsewhere, and some European cities. They have programs which leave free bicycles, good mm-hmm. heavy-duty free bikes around the city, so that anyone can take one, ride it somewhere, and then leave it in a designated spot to be picked up by someone else. We even have some entrepreneurs have come up with the idea of leaving small cars around for rent in a way that you can, in effect, pick them up, rent them, use them for single trips, and leave them off again. Sharing resources is a great thing to think about. How can we do that? And by the way, as with a small car thing, there's even a way to make a buck off that. I don't mind people. We need to live. We need to make a living. But let's find ways of sharing resources and making a profit off of sharing resources if we're going to do this. But ultimately, it comes back again to our right as citizens to work together to use public power and public resources on our behalf. Look, private property, there's no point in going to war against private property in America. This is a country built on private property, and there are many parts of it that are very good. But what we do want to say is that we have a right as citizens to regulate private property and make sure that private property doesn't trump public goods. And just as with eminent domain and so forth, a democratic community has a right to say in some cases the rights of private property are overcome. There are many other places in which the community has a right to say here private property is so jeopardizing the rights of the community that the rights of a property holder have to be trumped by those goods. And again, it's the fact that it's so out of whack, the balance is so out of whack. It's always the private property holder, it's always the individual, it's always the consumer who trumps. And somehow in the last 30 or 40 years, democratic institutions, the people, the citizens, citizenship have taken a back seat, and it's time we right that balance.
And we'll have to leave it there. Lots of interest in this issue. Benjamin Barber, thank you very much for being with us.
So good to be with you and your wonderful listeners again.
Yes. Consumed is the book, How Markets Corrupt Children, Infantilize Adults, and Swallow Citizens Whole. Benjamin Barber, the author. More information on his own website, BenjaminBarber.com. You can also read more about the Civ World project that he's a part of at civworld.org. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this program and to Steve Williams for on-air production. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.